At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
5 days, 5 minutes, we'll do the week that was, of course, because it's Friday. We'll do a couple of corporate stories, and then why office paper is the size it is. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Friday today, November the 8th. Good as always to have you along, everybody. Cutting to the chase is the order of the day today. What happened in this economy the last 5 days and why? Kate Davidson's at the Wall Street Journal. Sudeep Reddy is at Politico. They are both in our studios in Washington, District of Columbia. Hey, everybody.
Hey, Kai.
Hi, Kai.
So, Sudeep, let me start with you, and it's a little bit of a wind-up to this question, so bear with me. There I was this morning, listening, as I do, to a certain other public radio program, no names, but the initials are Morning Edition, and on comes one Peter Navarro, trade advisor to the President of the United States, and he is asked about this report yesterday that the White House has, lo and behold, agreed to reduce tariffs as part of getting this trade deal done. And Navarro says, you have to talk to President Donald J. Trump. He's the only one who counts. And then lo and behold, 4 or 5 hours later, there is President Donald J. Trump on the White House driveway, standing in front of helicopters, as he does. And he says, oh, no, I'm not reducing or lowering tariffs. I don't know what you're talking about. So with that as the windup and all this talk about a trade deal being oh so close to done, what do you make of it?
It's kind of wild. We have two long-running trade wars. One is the one between the U.S. and China.
Yeah.
The other one is the one inside the administration among all of Trump's advisors. There are people like Peter Navarro who want a much harder line, who really want to extract some severe concessions from China and really knock it to them and get the U.S. manufacturing economy going in a different way. And there are another group. There's another group that's like, oh, boy, like what's going on here? This is going to get really ugly. Do we really want to go down that road? The best part of the story, though, is that the Chinese have figured out the game. They've started to speak the Trump language,
right.
And they know that Trump can goose markets and get people excited in the stock market and create some leverage that way. And the Chinese have learned that, oh, if they say the tariffs are coming off, then the market's going to be up. And if Trump doesn't pull the tariffs off, then the market's going to go down. And they know how to play the exact same game. It's not necessarily always based on fact, as we've learned, but it's still a game that has some high stakes around it.
So look, Kate, we have been here before, right? Back in May, we thought there was a deal, and then poof, it goes nowhere. And now here we are again. The election's getting closer. Help me out.
We have. You know, I think one thing that's interesting, I was talking to a smart economist this week who said, you know, these recession fears that we'd been hearing about have kind of ebbed a little bit. Maybe we'll be talking about that again or a little more later. But, you know, people are now not expecting that things maybe will be okay. We might have this phase one deal heading into next year. But it's kind of all premised on this idea that there'll be this big turnaround in business and investment. And I guess you have to assume that CEOs are going to see something signed and say, hey, great, it's all good. And it's just hard to see how they do that. They have this big turnaround in sentiment given how kind of volatile things are with this administration. So
well,
I think it's just more uncertainty.
Yeah, but Sudeep, let's remember, right, that even if the Chinese do come to the table and the Trump administration goes to the table and there is some kind of deal, there are still European tariffs, there are still steel and aluminum tariffs, there are still a whole roster of trade impedances out there.
Yeah, and the key to the China trade deal is that we're talking about phase one.
Yeah.
phase one is really like a key tip off that this is in large part a political deal to give the president some currency on the campaign trail in 2020 to say, hey, I'm working out a deal. I'll work out the rest of it on November 4th, right after the election.
Right.
But like, look at all the things I'm doing and I'm on track, right? Because right now he's kind of empty handed, except for the pain he's created for farmers and factories across America.
All right. So look, Kate, about that November 4th thing, right? The thing that a lot of people are betting the president has to have for his reelection campaign is a healthy economy. And you'll remember that 6 months ago, everybody was saying, oh, my goodness, there's a recession coming. Now we are not saying that. You wrote about it today in the Journal. What happened that now everything seems to be fine?
It's not really clear. I mean, things have gotten marginally better, I guess. Employers are still adding jobs. I think that's the biggest thing folks are looking at, right? Retail sales are still pretty strong. Consumers are, paychecks are still growing. Folks are still spending money. It's just, we've talked about this so many times. How long will that last? How long can consumers continue to prop up the economy when manufacturing is weak? And it's not just the trade war. There's this global slowdown, which of course is it's all kind of intersecting. It's tied to the trade war. But I think that's really the big question.
Yeah. And Sudeep, it's a mood thing, right? This whole, we're not going to have a recession now thing.
It is entirely a mood thing, and it is a divergence, actually a somewhat worrying divergence. Consumers are relatively upbeat. We see that in consumer sentiment. Yeah. We see that in consumer spending. We see that in the job market. We see that in wage growth. The consumer measures are actually looking pretty good, but the consumer measures are never the first thing to go. The first thing to go are the business-related measures, and we've already seen trouble in business investment. We've already seen weaker CEO confidence. All of that becomes the big concern that tends to ricochet and hit consumers afterward. And that's the thing that we have to watch for, because those are the early warning signs.
And watch we will. Happens. Sudeep Reddy at Politico, Kate Davidson at The Wall Street Journal. Thanks, you two. Really appreciate it.
Thanks, Kai.
Thank you.
All right. Quick in and out today. Sorry we didn't have more time. See you. On Wall Street today, a little of this, a little of that. Details, numbers, you know the drill. You'll remember perhaps the name Adam Neumann, the founder and now former CEO of WeWork, made $1.7 billion richer after being ousted by the company's main investor after that spectacularly failed initial public offering. You undoubtedly don't know the names of thousands of WeWork employees waiting to be laid off after that spectacularly failed initial public offering. But some of them, in the order of hundreds, have banded together with some demands to make of management before people are shown the door. This is part of a growing trend of employee activism happening outside the traditional channels of union-based collective bargaining. Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino has that one.
Just over a year ago this week, thousands of Google employees in dozens of locations around the world walked off the job to protest how the company handles sexual harassment complaints.
We demand structural change.
Since then, we've seen a surge in employee activism, protests at online retailer Wayfair over selling furniture to ICE, and at Amazon over its climate policies. This trend of informal worker activism is spreading, says Michelle Miller with Coworker.org, a nonprofit digital platform that helps workers organize petitions and actions online.
We're seeing that across multiple sectors, multiple classes of people, multiple kinds of jobs.
Coworker.org has helped workers from baristas to grocery clerks demand change on everything from family leave policies to tattoo and beard bans in the workplace.
Workers are saying, look, we're just going to take action ourselves. We're going to use social media to organize, and we see that that has an impact.
Thomas Kokin is a professor of industrial relations at MIT. In surveys of thousands of workers, he found the majority want more of a voice on a variety of labor issues. And while most were interested in joining a union, informal actions like these have the potential to address issues more quickly, according to Sharon Block at Harvard Law School.
It's understandable that workers want a process that's more agile and can be more responsive to their needs in the moment.
Block says forming a union to bargain with an employer can be a years-long process, even if it has the advantage that it's legally binding for the employer to negotiate on the issues. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
Just because there aren't enough places to buy stuff online, Facebook is trying to get people to shop, or at least window shop, in its messaging app, WhatsApp, just like it did with Instagram earlier this year, all in service of finding ways to make money besides ads. Marketplace's Erica Barris reports.
Isa LaPera runs a small bakery out of her home in São Carlos, Brazil. She was a beta tester for this new feature. Her catalog shows pictures of cookies, cupcakes, and her popular brownie pizza for 30 Brazilian reals. Because the catalog helped answer customer questions about what she makes, she had more time to actually bake.
Because I only have two hands, so I can make it faster and, of course, and make more money with that.
Facebook bought WhatsApp a few years ago for $19 billion, and it's trying to find more ways to make some of that back. The text-like social media platform has 1.5 billion users around the world, and many use it to talk to family, friends, and lately, businesses.
WhatsApp is actually part of Facebook's long-term strategy to show that it's not a one-trick pony. It's not just dependent completely on Facebook. It's got these other products.
Kartik Hossinger teaches business at the Wharton School. You can't buy anything through a WhatsApp catalog, so Facebook won't be making any money from it directly. But he says it's important to keep businesses happy and using the app a lot.
All of this makes that conversation with the customer seamless for the small business owner. The idea would be that if WhatsApp can help these small business owners drive transactions and sales, then Facebook can actually monetize that very effectively.
And if this takes off, LaPera may be able to sell that brownie pizza without ever leaving WhatsApp. I'm Erica Barris for Marketplace.
Best guesses are that tropical deforestation is responsible for about 10% of total annual global CO2 emissions. And I'm sorry to have to say this, chocolate is part of the problem. Most cocoa farming is done in West Africa on more than a million mostly small farms. And those cocoa farmers, mostly poor, mostly just scratching out a living, trying to make a little more money, cut down trees to expand their plots. Steve Mufson wrote about this in the Washington Post and how companies, American and otherwise, are trying to lessen the damage that our chocolate habit does. Steve, welcome to the program.
Glad to be here.
There is a line in this piece, a quote, actually, that I want to get your take on. It says, anytime someone bites on a chocolate bar in the United States, a tree is being cut down. Hyperbolic and apocryphal or close to real life?
Well, a little hyperbolic. I'm not exactly sure what the candy bar to tree ratio is, but there's no question that global demand for chocolate's been going up. And the more the demand for chocolate goes up, the more deforestation is going to be in places like Ivory Coast and Ghana.
You talk about one of the big chocolate companies, Mars, and its efforts to become sustainable in its sourcing of cocoa and some other things. It's a really, really difficult problem.
Terribly difficult. And I think that Mars has been sincere. They've done some things that other companies haven't done. And yet, it's not been enough. And it's important to note that, you know, Mars is not alone. There are a lot of companies out there in the chocolate business. They've been fairly open about their own emissions. They count their emissions all the way down to the small farmers, which is, you know, more than a lot of companies do.
Let me ask you about certification, right? Because much has been made, not just in cocoa, but in coffee and lumber. And, you know, we're going to certify this stuff as sustainable and what have you. Does that actually work?
Well, it has not worked in the Ivory Coast and in Ghana. So the little green frog that you see on your candy bar that makes you feel good about buying that has got some serious trouble. And so the Rainforest Alliance is trying to go in and repair and retrain people. But I think it's just indicative of how difficult it is to achieve this goal in this part of the world.
So look, if I go out now and have a Snickers bar after lunch or some M&Ms, Mars products, should I have second thoughts?
Well, you can say that about so many things you do. I mean, how did you get to work today, Kai?
Yeah, I drove my minivan, man.
You go. That may have done more harm than the Snickers bar.
There was another. I started with a quote, and I'll end with a quote. There was another piece, and I think it's the kicker in your piece. Another quote about. People, I forget who it was, and I apologize, saying the global supply chain is broken and we're not going to be able to fix any of these things unless we fix the global supply chain.
Right. Well, that was someone from Mars, actually, who said that, who's also the chairman of the World Cocoa Foundation. And I think what's happening is that a lot of companies are taking a more active role on the ground in these places. It's a huge bookkeeping operation to do this, but more and more of that sort of thing is happening.
Because that's what it's got to take. Steve Mufson covers the business of climate change for the Washington Post. Fascinating piece, totally depressing piece, to be honest with you, about climate change and deforestation and the global cocoa supply chain. Steve, thanks a lot. I appreciate it.
Thanks very much.
Coming up.
Colors, options, sizes, weights, everything in between, textures, finishes. It's an endless world.
Trust me, it is more interesting than you probably think it is. First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials flat today, 27,681. The NASDAQ up 40 points, 0.4%, 84.75. The S&P 500 advanced 7 points, 0.2%, 3,093. For the week, the Dow gained 1.2%, the NASDAQ up 1.1%, the S&P 500 found 0.8% today. Disney shares up 3.7% today after it reported earnings per share that were better than expected. Disney reported a more than 50% increase in studio entertainment revenue. Can you say strong box office movie performance, Marvel Universe? Hello, Gap down 7.6% today after news late yesterday that CEO Art Peck is stepping down. Immediately, Gap also warned results for the current quarter are not going to be as good as expected. Bonds fell. Yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 1.94%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Hey, Molly Wood here. Self-determination for Native Americans is one of the more fraught issues in American history. And one result is that tribes have a very unique structure to their local economies. Now some tribes are looking to tech and financial technology specifically to help diversify and strengthen those economies.
So the last 45 years under self-determination has been this great experiment playing out with tribal governments. And when you look at where tribes are today, I don't think there's a more exciting time to really be in this space.
This week on Make Me Smart, the future of Native American economies. Find us on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. 9th of November, 1989, 30 years ago tomorrow, the Berlin Wall comes down, the Cold War is basically over, communism loses, Germany, of course, celebrates more than the rest of the world. Reunification was formalized the following October, but reintegrating those two starkly different economies has been long, and it's been hard, and it's been expensive. And in spite of all the time and the money, an economic wall still does stand. From Berlin, Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports.
Most of the Berlin Wall is long gone, but a few bits survive. There are two short stretches here in the north of the city, a grim, unlovely relic watched over devotedly by Axel Klausmeier of the Berlin Wall Memorial Foundation.
Although it's, of course, a very ugly built structure in the middle of a booming city, it is a permanent reminder that democracy is so fragile and we have to fight for it. And that's what we can learn from this site here.
There are more remnants of the communist past in this industrial museum on the site of what was the center of East German electronic engineering. This jamming device was built here to block American radio broadcasts. And there's the first Soviet TV set made here. It has a sliding door to cover the screen when not in use. Tour guide Claudia Haley says it was Stalin, bizarrely, who insisted on that refinement.
So that you wouldn't have the feeling that the party was watching over you all the time.
Big Brother is watching.
Big Brother is watching.
So even Stalin was worried about Big Brother.
He was worried about Big Brother watching him.
Most of the companies whose products are on display here shrank or collapsed after the wall came down. They couldn't compete with more efficient, consumer-oriented Western rivals. Among older Easterners, like Dieter Schmidt, there's a lingering bitterness.
This team,
everything was shut down. The firm I worked for, there were 2,500 people working there. They just bulldozed it. Why? Because they only wanted our order books. They wanted to put us out of business. They didn't give a damn about the staff, the people.
Many older Easterners feel the same. 79-year-old economic historian Jörg Rössel says West German companies were allowed to plunder their Eastern counterparts. The West, he says, threw the East to the wolves.
I'm deeply disappointed that they were not able to give the East a chance to reconstruct, and that did not happen.
Western taxpayers pour $2 trillion into improving the infrastructure and the social safety net in the East. But Rössel says a lot of that was wasted. If Eastern companies had been protected against Western competition for up to 5 years, a whole generation would not have been thrown out of work and made to feel worthless.
So they could be proud of the unified Germany.
As it is, there's widespread disillusion in the East. Only 38%, according to one recent poll, think that reunification has been a success. There are individual successes. Here's one Eastern company that didn't fall into the clutches of the big bad wolf. Little Red Riding Hood sparkling wine. The boss, Christoph Kreiser, says business is booming.
Every second bottle of sparkling wine that is consumed in Germany comes from our company.
But Little Red Riding Hood is a rarity, almost a fairy tale. The general reality is gloomy. The East is much better off than it was under communism, but it's not as well off as the West. Unemployment's higher, wages about 16% lower. The main reason for the underperformance, says government minister for the Eastern States, Christian Hirte, is a huge brain drain.
The best, most motivated and mobile people get up and went to the West and made their living there.
2 million left the East in the turbulent years after reunification, he says, and they're not coming back.
It will be a problem for decades.
Even so, 30 years after the fall of the wall, Axel Klausmeier of the Wall Memorial Foundation says Germany has much to celebrate, despite the huge cost of reunification.
The question is, what is the value of freedom, and can you measure it in coins? It's priceless.
In Berlin, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Sometimes in this economy, it's the little things that can lead to bigger discoveries. Luckily for us, we've got a series built around exactly that idea, a thing we do called I've Always Wondered.
If you wonder...
By asking 1,000 questions to get one answer, by brain work and blade work.
Pretty simple format. Your questions, our answers.
Hi, this is Steve McGillivray from Fountain Hills, Arizona. And my question is, why is American paper based on the 8.5 by 11 inch sheet size?
It's a good one, right? Kind of arbitrary size when you think about it. Steve also wants to know why legal paper is 8.5 by 14. And now so do we. Marketplace's Jack Stewart is on that one.
For a lot of us, the only time we give paper much thought is when the printer in the office is out. But you know what? Paper is fascinating.
Colors, options, sizes, weights, everything in between, textures, finishes. It's an endless world.
Corey Ivorone is with paperworks.com, which sells paper products to consumers and businesses.
I really thought I understood paper, and that was until I started working for a paper company, and I understood that I knew about 1%.
Well, he knows a lot more now after 10 years in the business, but still, he's never really given a second thought to the size of letter paper.
That's how it is. It's just 8.5 by 11. So I'm actually interested in listening in and finding out what the actual answer is.
Okay, let's have a go at figuring it out. First, I turned to Mark Pitts. He's from the American Forest and Paper Association.
I think the real basis for trying to come up with standard sizes goes back to the 1600s, actually.
Early papermakers dipped wooden-framed screens or molds of various sizes into vats of water and pulp. These vat men would then heave them back out, all by hand, and then once they'd left them to dry, they'd end up with two large sheets of paper.
One of the common sizes that came about, according to industry folklore, was a size that was about 44 inches wide, and supposedly that represented about the maximum width that a vat man could spread his arms and still hold the mold.
Cut that 44 inches in half, twice, and you get 11-inch long paper. You can actually find some of these old molds at the Papermaking Museum at Georgia Tech in Atlanta. Virginia Howell's the director there, and she says the frames themselves show evidence of the papermaking process and wear from those vat men's outstretched arms.
You can just imagine 30 or 40 years of somebody using the same tool every day and how it's really formed to fit their hands by that point.
So the size of the mold was the origin of standard paper sizes, and then along came typewriters and photocopiers and printers and their need for very exacting standards, because of course there's nothing more annoying than a paper jam. So if we've settled then on letter size at 8.5 by 11, why is there also legal-sized paper which is 3 inches longer? Some experts do think it was used by legal professions who needed the extra space for those long and wordy contracts. But Corey Ivorone says law firms actually now mostly buy standard letter paper too. He only sees one type of customer for legal paper.
Restaurants cannot buy enough of 8.5x14 paper. That is who that market is for right now.
It turns out it's ideal for long restaurant menus, and it's cheap enough to replace every day. And folded in half, it's great for cocktail menus, and in half again for the daily specials. So, our weird paper sizes live on. I'm Jack Stewart for Marketplace.
We obviously need your help with this series, right? Can't do our answers unless we've got your questions. Send them to us at our website, marketplace.org. Final note on the way out today, the end of an era, but an era probably nobody is going to miss. Listeners of a certain age, and historians as well, will remember doing research or college papers and having to go to the library, inevitably down in the basement somewhere, usually in a musty corner, and having to scroll through reel after reel of microfilm to find the particular newspaper article they were looking for. Well, no more, because the internet, of course, but also because effective December 31st, the Library of Congress is no longer going to require publishers to submit microfilm copies of their papers. All right, we're out of here. The Dow mostly flat today. The NASDAQ up 40 points. That is 0.4%. The S&P 500, 7 points to the good, 0.2%. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace's executive producer is Nancy Fargali. Deborah Clark is the senior vice president and general manager. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you Monday. Everybody, have yourselves a great weekend, all right? This is APN.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.